Welcome to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Yesterday, municipal elections were held across Iowa. In Sioux City, three incumbent candidates for the city council, Dan Moore, Alex Waters, and Pete Gretkin, were returned to the council for four-year terms. Jake Jungers, Denny Quinn, and Doug Waples were the challengers, and they were first-time candidates. They failed to win any of the open seats. In other political news, when Bill Anderson announced his decision to resign from his Iowa Senate District 3 seat a few months ago, Todd Wendt of Lamar's began thinking about running for that office. The district covers Morningside in Sioux City and parts of Plymouth County, including Lamar's. Wendt had just retired after 17 years as the superintendent of schools in Lamar's. Wendt comes from a Democratic family. His father served in the Iowa House years ago. He's running for that Senate seat against Republican Iowa House Representative Jim Carlin, who represents Siouxland's 6th House District. Wendt says his many years in education have given him the experience he needs to take on state issues.
For a lot of months leading up to my retirement in June, people would ask me what my next step was going to be. And my father was in the legislature for 8 or 9 years, I think, and had just a wonderful experience. So I think a lot of times people thought that would be a logical next step for me, and I kept saying, no, that's not what I wanted to do at the time. This opportunity came up with Senator Anderson accepting another job. I had some people approach me about running, and I remember back to the experience that my father and mother had serving in the legislature, and decided I wasn't quite yet done with what I wanted to do for primarily for education across the state. I think it's important to move to that next level, to the policy level. I've worked in education for 34 years as a teacher and administrator and coach, and followed legislative activities very closely. I'm just ready for that challenge to work at the policy level in the state for education.
What are some things that, in particular, a couple of things maybe you would like to see changed in how education is maybe funded or organized?
I would like to see education become the priority that it once was in Iowa. And we need to fund our priorities. We can't just talk about what our priorities are. Having been a superintendent for 21 years in the state of Iowa, I've seen quite a bit of range of funding that's come from the state level. And we are in a period now in the last 5 to 7 years where we're at a historic lows for the amount of general funding that comes to schools. And I think also community college funding is down, Regents funding is down.
Yeah, higher education suffered too.
Yes. So while we talk about education being a priority, we're not following up that priority with our funding. So that would be a huge thing for me to work on. Another thing that's happened more recently, again, being in public employment all my life and knowing the value of the service that people in my business, in education, provide, and the value and service that people in city and county government provide, it seems like there's been a attack might be a strong word, but there seems like there's been a devaluing of public service and public employment. And I'd like to work to kind of turn that around at the legislative level. The people I worked with for 34 years are great people. They do great things for kids. It's just a shame from my point of view to see some of the things that have been taken away from public employees in the last year or two.
It sounds like public employees are going to be paying a lot more out of pocket for health care because of this collective bargaining law. And how do you think that affects someone who is a teacher?
See, what people forget often is that over the years, through bargaining, teachers and other public employees have bargained for the safety and security of quality health insurance, and many times at the expense of salary. So to all of a sudden now start talking about how they, teachers and other public employees, need to contribute more to their health plan. Well, they have contributed to their health plan over the years through the bargaining process. Now, do we have to strike a balance and do what's affordable for school districts and for state government? Yes. But I think it's kind of a misnomer that that they haven't been paying for health care. They have. Maybe not directly into the program, but like I say, it's been at the expense of salary increases over the years.
It seems like the benefits have always been a big part of the pay for public employees, because the pay is not usually as high, perhaps, if they would have been in the private sector.
Yeah, and people now will argue that the public employee pay in the state of Iowa, especially in education, is as good as private sector, although I think it's hard to compare the two. But it wasn't that long ago that it was a priority at the state level to raise teacher pay and to recruit people into the profession. Now that we are starting to see better pay and those, still those good solid benefits, now all of a sudden people are saying, well, wait a minute, that's not really what we meant. Well, either you believe that educators should be paid more or you don't. And I happen to believe that that we should pay them for what their value is. And I don't think that salaries and benefits are out of line. I think, as I said earlier, those people provide a wonderful service for us. And there is nothing more important than working with our young kids and getting them ready for their future. And that's what people in public education do.
It's kind of hard for them to plan a future if they can't afford college. And it seems like in the last few years, the college funding, the subsidies to the state universities have gone down and down. What can be done about that? It seems like the state says, look, we're out of money. Is it the state's fault they're out of money? Do you think some Democrats have said there's been fiscal mismanagement on the part of the state?
Yeah, and that's another one of the things that I really want to work on. Having been a superintendent for 21 years, obviously we have to be responsible with our tax policy as in a school district. And I would like to work on that at the state level. In the years I was in Lamar's, we had times where we lowered our tax levy rate, which is what we can control. And we had times where we had to increase it. But we always tried to do that responsibly. And when we lowered our tax rate, we tried to do that responsibly so that two or three years down the road, we wouldn't create problems that I think we're seeing in state government right now. It's not any big revelation that if you cut taxes, your revenue is likely to go down. All the hope about growth in the economy and things that are talked about when we reduce taxes, I don't believe we've seen at this point. And again, that's one of my big things, is to be responsible about our tax policy and about our fiscal management. Now, I'm all for cutting taxes when we can, but we need to do it responsibly. I think some of the state funding issue we have right now has been self-imposed by those currently in charge at the state level.
What do you think the role of the state should be in social issues? In this last legislative session, a lot of talk about abortion, who's paying for abortions, who should be able to get state money if they're providing abortions, talking about diversity issues for instance, you know, gay and trans students in schools. How much of a role do you think the state should play when it comes to those kinds of issues?
I think that the state has an obligation to protect the rights of individuals, regardless of their protected class. Although this might be a place where I'm not as socially liberal as some others in our party, at some point in time, that protection of those rights can't infringe upon the rights of the rest of the folks, or the majority of the people. I think the defunding of Planned Parenthood, that was more of a political move than an actual, it was a statement that was being made. I myself am not somebody that thinks I should make the decision about an abortion or not for somebody. That's an individual person's decision to be made in consultation with their family and their church, their faith leaders, and their doctors and medical people. But bottom line, Mary, is that I don't believe that we should legislate that type of thing. We shouldn't mandate what people do on that issue.
If you would be elected and have this Senate seat, what could you bring with you that would be particularly, you know, helpful?
Yeah, I think a couple things that I think I can bring to this. First of all, I can bring a lot of background and knowledge about education and what works and what doesn't work, and what we need to do in the field of education. I also think, as you mentioned, I had earned my doctorate from the University of South Dakota, and I've been a superintendent for 21 years. I have experience in managing budgets. In Lamar's, our budget, while it's not large compared to the state level or even to the Sioux City school level, we had a $24 million budget that we managed over 17 years. So I bring that experience, some fiscal management experience, and hopefully along with that, some common sense about what to do financially. I'm not a big risk taker financially. I'm probably more conservative in that area than a lot of folks might be. I think over the years, again, one more thing about my experience as an administrator, you have to learn to listen to both sides of an issue and try to come up with some type of a solution that works for everybody. And now it's not going to be perfect for everybody, but you listen to both sides and then you make decisions that hopefully meet the needs of as many people as you can. That's just kind of the nature of the work. So I bring that as well. I'm willing to sit down and talk to anybody about ideas. I have ideas, but I think we need to start making decisions that help us meet the priorities and the needs of Iowans, and more specifically, people in Senate District 3.
I guess finally, last year was a terribly partisan year, both on the national level and the state level, and it looks like this year will be another year like that. Do you feel prepared to deal with all that?
Yeah, I do, and I I'm going to go back to my role as a school administrator and my role as a superintendent. Many times, I'd like to say that there's always two sides to every issue. And sometimes the best solution is to find common ground. And yeah, I'm ready to make that step at the next level and meet that challenge. You know, one of the things I remember most about my dad's service when he was serving in the Iowa House of Representatives and toward the end of his service, we heard from Democrats and Republicans how much they valued the fact that he would sit down and talk with anybody and try to find that common ground. That's something I learned from him, among a lot of other things. But that served me well in my role as superintendent, and I think it would also serve me well in my role as a state senator. You have to listen to folks and then try to find common ground.
It seems like this district is a very conservative district. It's been hard for Democrats to make headway in this district. How are you going to handle that?
You are right. This district, which includes almost all of Plymouth County and then a large part of the Morningside area, the registered Republicans to the number of registered Democrats is something like 2-1. What I'm hoping is that people will listen to my views, listen to what I have to say, and not think about party lines when they go to vote, but that they go to vote for the person. And that's going to be the only way I have a chance in this election is for people to hear what I have to say, to understand that, I'm not a far left liberal Democrat. I'm more of a moderate Democrat, but people are going to need to switch over and be willing to vote for the person and not just necessarily the party. So I'm hoping that happens. Since I've announced my intention to seek the nomination, I've had a lot of my good Republican friends in Lamar's come up to me and say that they don't often vote for a Democrat, but that they would vote for me. So again, I think if people take the time to get to know me, and if I do my job at getting out and meeting people and listening to people, I'm hoping that'll help with overturning that large number of registered Republicans and registered Democrats.
That was Todd Wendt. The recently retired superintendent of the Lamar's public school system is running as a Democrat for Iowa's 3rd District Senate seat, recently vacated by the retirement of Bill Anderson. He will likely face Siouxland's 6th District House Representative, Republican Jim Carlin, who won his seat just a year ago. Iowa House District 6 includes Sergeant Bluff, Bronson, Salix, and the Morningside area of Sioux City. The Woodbury and Plymouth County Democrats are holding a joint nominating convention for their candidate this Saturday in Merrill. Listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Young entrepreneurs who are often still in college are sometimes confused about where to start when they have a business idea. The Iowa Startup Games is one way to help them move forward with their ideas. The games begin this Friday at ISU Design West and continue through Sunday. This semi-incubator program is run by John Engel. Engel is a University of Iowa lecturer with the Papa John Entrepreneurial Center and an adjunct professor at Western Iowa Tech Community College. Engel says this is the second year of the entrepreneurial program that covers every stage of bringing a product to market and selling it. But it's just one part of a larger launch week to support local entrepreneurs in Siouxland.
So there's a tremendous amount going on in the city of Sioux City over the next week. And it's really an effort. I think it was really started by Renee Billings and Sam Wagner. And they put together this programming for the city to encourage entrepreneurship. And so they've got a bunch of educational programming. Google is coming. Iowa State is coming. Of course, the University of Iowa will have the Iowa Startup Games. So we have a lot of different partners that are investing in the city of Sioux City and in the entrepreneurship community here. And recently, actually, someone from the state came and said that they were looking at a heat map of entrepreneurship in the state of Iowa, and Sioux City popped out.
That's very encouraging.
Yeah, it's very exciting to see how much people are willing to invest in themselves and each other. One of the things that I love is the cooperation that I see among my former students. So many of them will see that I'm doing a program and they'll ask if they can come and be a coach or an assistant or just be involved in some way. You know, I consistently have no problem recruiting judges and coaches. You know, there are a lot of people in the city of Sioux City who are very giving and really believe in the idea of encouraging entrepreneurship.
So this is a three-day event, really, and the students come in and they work on their ideas and you have mentors there. Tell me a little bit about the process.
Yeah, actually, this is the coolest college class you could ever imagine. We charge no tuition and you can earn money at the end. So this is how it works. On Friday night, the students come and they pitch an idea that they care about or they listen to other students' ideas. And then they get a chance to vote for the ideas that they like the best. And we typically do somewhere between 7 and 10 ideas. So that students will form into teams. And over the course of the weekend, they learn the lean startup methodology that was developed at Stanford. And they learn that methodology and they apply it to whatever business that they're working on. And they have the opportunity to get access to people who have been in business 30, 40 years in Sioux City, who coach them through issues of marketing, finance, operations. And then at the end of the weekend, they present to some of the top executives in the Siouxland community. And it's a very exciting weekend.
What is that lean methodology? Can you explain that a little bit?
Absolutely. So the lean startup methodology is one of the most popular methodologies that people are focusing on. And it was developed by a man named Steve Blank. And Steve looked at startups and he thought, you know, people will go and they'll have an idea and they'll develop a product and then they'll go see if there's a market for it. Why not first understand if there's a market? So with the Lean Startup methodology, what we do is we first focus on the customer. And we send the students out to get to know their customers and understand what are their true pain points. And then they come back and they create a minimum viable product to address that pain point. And that's very powerful because they've established that there's a need for what it is that they want to work on.
Yeah, I mean, whenever I've watched that show, Shark Tank, when people come in with their ideas, and they're really interesting ideas, one of the first questions one of those judges asks them is, okay, who wants it? Is anyone buying it? What's going on? Who are your customers?
Absolutely, and those are the same kinds of questions that we ask, right? So you want to know what the need is, you know, how critical that need is, and then who has it, and how are you going to reach them? And then ultimately, what's the size of the opportunity? Is this a big enough need that it's worth building a business around?
So the students will work with each other. They'll brainstorm. They'll refine. And I believe on Sunday, then they will present their ideas, their refined ideas. Is that how it works?
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that I loved about last year, I remember doing the Iowa Startup Games last year, and a couple of the students came back to us, and I was there with Bobby Rogers from Sportsman's. And they said to us, you know, she's interested. She likes her idea. And we said, did you get a purchase order? And they said, what's a purchase order? And so Bobby and I worked with them, and we worked through a pitch to the owner of the business that they were talking to. And they went back. They came back to us, and they said, she wants to buy $7,000. So in a weekend, these girls had sold $7,000.
That's pretty amazing.
It was absolutely amazing. Yes. Yeah.
What do you think the hardest part is, especially for students when they have an idea, they think it's a good idea. Okay, they go out and they, you know, figure out what the need is and what it would take to develop it. Do you think it really is just saying, you know, asking someone for their business? Is that one of the hardest parts?
Absolutely. You know, I see so many entrepreneurs over the course of my career. And ultimately, the people that get what they want in life are the people that ask for it. So it's asking, it's listening, and it's really having empathy. So if you listen to people, they will tell you what they need. And every day I see business ideas around me. I wish I could address all the needs that I encounter because I see them all the time. And you start to become attuned to that. And when you're attuned to other people's needs and you really focus your efforts on solving them, you know, there's no end to what you can accomplish.
Now, is this the second one of these weekends that you've had?
Well, we have them all over the state. So it's the second one we've had in Sioux City. But we hold Iowa Startup Games across the state.
What kind of reaction have you gotten from students who've been in on those? Do you sort of chart where they go from there, what kind of success they have?
We try to the extent that we can. One of the things that really struck me the other day when I was talking to the students at Morningside College, one of them that had gone to Startup Games last year, and she had actually gone as a freshman. She was nervous, and she would ask a lot of questions of the coaches, and we kind of adopted her. We loved her because she was so driven to learn, and she really wanted to be successful in the games. And one of the things she said to me is, she said, John, you know, last year I did things that I never thought I could do. And we really helped her get out of her shell and gain confidence. And I can't wait to see what she does this year.
I was reading online about some of the main issues that most young entrepreneurs have, and three of the top issues, and this was out of Forbes magazine, some of the common mistakes. Number one, the lack of understanding what really motivates people. Number two, the fact you can't do everything yourself. And number three, you have to be open about your ideas.
Absolutely. You have to be open to, you have to be able to listen and adjust. And, you know, that's one of the things that I love about this weekend, because each of those three issues that you brought up are things that we address in the course of the weekend.
As someone who is running this project, it must be really rewarding for you to see, you know, these students go in the first day and come out of it with a highly developed sort of project at the end, because they've only been there for 3 days.
Yes, it's mind-blowing to see how much they accomplish. in such a short amount of time. It's actually it's not even 3 days. It's really 48 hours. And in that time, they accomplish so much. You know, I think what happens with a lot of people is that they get caught up in fear and so they don't take action. And because we've compressed everything into a weekend, they have no choice but to take action. So we literally like kick them out the door and make them go talk to people. And, you know, I think that is what the key thing. It's the key thing that I found in my life as an entrepreneur is that action is where money is made. And so if you can get people to, you know, really believe in a deadline and feel like they need to accomplish something, then you'll see them accomplish a tremendous amount in a short amount of time.
Now, apparently you have worked before. You worked for the Federal Reserve. You've worked for several companies working on new product lines. What did you learn coming out of those experiences that sort of shape what you tell students now?
Oh, that's very interesting. So working at the Federal Reserve, I really got kind of a macro mindset of the economy. So I learned about drivers and thinking about how there are forces that impact and influence things. And if you can understand the drivers, then you can often understand what the outcomes will be. I helped launch Selling Insurance on the Internet. One of the things that I learned there was that you can pull ideas from different places and that those ideas can then be assembled and create a solution to a problem. I helped Citibank launch the PC banking for small businesses and find the early adopters of that. And in that case, what I learned there was that, you know, sometimes you'll learn something in life and not realize that you can apply it later. So when I was at Iowa, I learned how to do election forecasting. And when we were launching small business banking, and we wanted to find the early adopters, I realized that if I could forecast elections, I could forecast who would be the early adopters. And so we used those same techniques in that method. And then, you know, I've had the opportunity to work in 12 different countries, so I've had a lot of exposure to different people and different ideas, and it's made me open to thinking about change and realizing that, you know, I may do something one way, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's the best way. There are many other ways to do things. A great example of that is taking off your shoes when you walk in your house. When I was in Asia, that's something that we did all the time, and now I do it all the time here because it just makes all the sense. Why would you want to track dirt and germs into your house? So I think that, you know, through all of my experiences, I've really gained this idea of having an adventurous mind and being, I think of myself as kind of an explorer. And I try to bring that to my students and encourage them to be explorers and being open to the opportunities that are around them.
I think, too, when you're working on a team and you're working with people who come from different areas, different interests, but you all have ideas in common, goals in common, sometimes it's easier to share and cross-pollinate what you're doing, and you come up with a lot more than you ever would have thought of when you started.
Absolutely. And I can give you a great case example of that I learned when I was in my early 20s. When I was in my early 20s and I was working on this project for Citibank to find the early adopters of PC banking, the solution that we came up with was very mathematical, right? We were building these statistical equations that forecasted the probability that somebody would adopt something and the probability that they would be profitable, right? So that's very heavy math oriented. And the members of our team that were heavy math oriented and heavy data driven just loved it, right? But then there were other members of our team that were more artistic. And they couldn't understand what we were doing, and they felt left out. And my coach did a beautiful thing that I've often been influenced by since then. What he did was he thought of opportunities for them to use their skills. So he created a whole additional work stream that wasn't originally part of the project for them. And that work stream was around creating marketing collateral that was fun and funny, that would promote the product. And so I'll never forget walking into a bank branch in New York City and seeing those marketing pieces that my students had done right there in the line, you know, as I was walking up to the teller, they were right there. And those would have never existed if my mentor hadn't thought of this, adding this additional work stream. And so it opened the opportunity for them to be successful. And so it's important to realize that, you know, people think in different ways and everyone has value to contribute. And part of your role as a leader, and I really think that everybody on a team is a leader, part of your role is looking for those ways to create space for the other members of your team to use their talents and gifts. And, you know, when I learned that, it was a beautiful thing.
Is there something, you know, you'd like to say to encourage people?
One of the things that I would really like to encourage people to do is, if you've always had something that you wanted to do, just go ahead and do it. Don't be afraid. You know, there's more to be afraid by not doing things than there is by doing things. So just try. You know, nobody knows. When I started my business, I didn't know how to start a business. I had no clue. When I've done a lot of the things in my life, I had no clue what I was doing. But I just took those steps. And every time I took those steps, it opened up more and more opportunity for me. And so I would encourage anyone who's listening to this to, you know, go take those steps. Just take some action, try, help someone, and you'll be amazed at where your life can go.
That was John Engel of the University of Iowa and Western Iowa Tech Community College. He's running the Iowa Startup Games this weekend at ISU Design West in Sioux City. The weekend gives college students a chance to refine their business ideas and present them to mentors and judges. All next week, Western Iowa Tech and other organizations in Siouxland are hosting the 5th annual Launch Week to support innovation and entrepreneurship. Listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Once again, it's the holiday season. We just got through with Halloween, and the Christmas decorations are already up all over town and in the stores. Holidays like Thanksgiving and Christmas have long histories, and we don't often realize the connection between the holidays, religion, and culture. Morningside College professor and chair of religious studies Bruce Forbes has spent many years studying the backgrounds and histories of the holidays. His book, America's Favorite Holidays, explores how five of America's culturally important holidays, Christmas, Valentine's Day, Easter, Halloween, and Thanksgiving, came to be what they are today, seasonal and religious celebrations that are heavily influenced by modern popular culture. Forbes reveals the often surprising answers to questions about each holiday's traditions in that book. Forbes says he tends to call each of these holidays three-layer cakes.
I like analogies. And that is, the three layers are, first of all, every single one of those holidays started out as a seasonal celebration, like back in prehistory. And then secondly, a religion or a nation comes along and adds another layer of meaning. And then thirdly, modern popular culture does all kinds of crazy things to these holidays. So if you look at these holidays that we celebrate, they have all three layers to them. And what you're talking about in terms of the pagan background or something, I mean, pagan is a word that Christians have used for anything that's not Christian.
Right.
Well, it does make sense that human beings at seasonal changes would do something. I mean, if you survive winter and now it's spring, don't you want to kick up your heels? Or if the harvest is in and that work is done, wouldn't you like to do something? Or if it's really hard to survive winter, wouldn't it be nice to have a midwinter party in the middle of it? So I think these are natural human inclinations that people had before the United States was founded, before Jesus ever walked the earth. Those are seasonal celebrations. And we could call them pagan, or I just say, understandable human celebrations. And that's behind every one of these five holidays I've studied.
Some people I know that are sort of more strict Christians feel concerned about sort of dredging up the past of Halloween, the Celtic celebration of Halloween where the dead walk. They're sort of concerned about talking about that and encouraging that.
Right. Well, and the first quick thing I'd say, is it true that Halloween has pagan roots? If you mean non-Christian, yes, but I'd say they all do. That's the first thing. There are some special fears, I think, that Christians have, conservative Christians have. Some of them, I think, if you just don't want scary things, then I guess I understand that. The idea that this is a celebration rooted in worship of the devil, I think that's not true.
The occult, right.
Yeah. One big example here is the Celtic celebration in which this is rooted is spelled S-A-M-H-A-I-N, but you'd never guess with that spelling. It's pronounced Samhain. And there was an early British writer who said that was the name those people had for the Lord of the Dead, in other words, the devil. But the problem is that's not what that word means. It really means summer's end. No other literature says it's related to any name for a god. But once some people pick that up by that particular writer, and even in his time, people said, all this is a fabrication. He didn't have much credibility in his own time. That's been continued on. So I think you have some rumors like that that maybe make it worse.
Kids still celebrate and love Halloween and go trick-or-treating, mm-hmm. but it seems like it's a huge adult holiday now.
Yeah, it's when I trace the history of the holiday, it fascinates me. If you take, first of all, in the colonies, we had no Halloween. We only started to have Halloween when people from Scotland and Ireland settled here. Then it started as just a local ethnic holiday. Then it became national. And when it became national, it was mostly for adults. It's when the national thing got out of hand with young adults having too many tricks, you know, they got mean and damaging. Then what we'd say is we domesticated the holiday. And this is generally around World War II and afterwards. So for many of us, that's most of our memory. So we think Halloween has always been kids trick-or-treating. In fact, it's only been kids trick-or-treating right before and right after World War II. And in that whole period of time, when it was all safe for children and families, the adults were kind of shoved aside. I think what's happening now in the last 20, 25 years is the adults have said, wait a minute, we want our holiday back. And so you now have this children's holiday and the adults adding in on top of it. Why has it grown so much in the I could do the math there. Take all the candy we buy for kids, then have adults getting their own costumes. No wonder there's more and more in the stores.
Right, yeah. And it's such a fun holiday for most of us.
I think that's another thing I've thought. In these five holidays, the other four are mostly about rededicating yourself to something, to your nation or to relationships or to Christianity. Now, Halloween's not especially rededicating yourself. It's
right.
Kind of, it's just party time.
Right. And when I was in school, Catholic school, we always had the day off. The next day,
it was All
Saints Day.
Yes.
So all the kids in the public school across the street were always jealous. So we got the day off. So we always loved that.
Well, you know, we should mention here, I think a lot of people don't know where the word Halloween comes from. It's because All Saints Day, which is November 1st, celebrated by Catholics, but other people too, the old term for that is All Hallows. And so the Celtic celebration that they had was about the same time. So when Christianity comes in and has All Hallows Day, then the partying that they were used to doing, they just put that on the night before. It's a little like Mardi Gras before Lent. And so that's All Hallows Evening before All Hallows Day. And so Hallows Evening, you can see you shorten that up. That's how we get the term Halloween.
So going chronologically, Thanksgiving, mm-hmm. I think Thanksgiving has become one of the biggest holidays in this country because it seems to encompass everyone.
Yes. I'm interested in the tenacity of Thanksgiving because the other comment we make about it, it's being swallowed up. Because here you've got all this stuff for Halloween and then Christmas. And in fact, Thanksgiving in many ways seems to be just the launching day for Christmas shopping. So I think there are a number of people who fear that with Halloween and Christmas on both sides, Thanksgiving will lose out. What's really interesting is that it hasn't. For many people, it's one of the favorite holidays of the year in terms of travel. Look at airline travel. It's one of the most heavily traveled. So yes, I think it's central for Americans because of the reaffirmation of home and family and friendships. Yes.
In your book, you talk about how the Puritans, early settlers, came over and they would always celebrate the harvest. That was sort of part of what they did. Did this sort of develop into the kind of thing we think of as Thanksgiving? Did it take like an official holiday to be declared?
Yeah, it's an interesting history. The very beginnings are Puritans in New England, although their Thanksgiving days would be on special days. It wasn't one day in the year. Eventually, some Puritan colonies started to have something that was late. It wasn't really a harvest festival. It was even later because it was November or December. And the Puritans then, when they spread out through the rest of the country, they kept saying, we like this tradition. So they're kind of behind our Thanksgiving tradition. But it was not about the Pilgrims and the Indians that we talk about. They just first pushed it because we just need a good Thanksgiving day. And it didn't become part of an official annual celebration until Abraham Lincoln, in one year, proclaimed it. And then shortly thereafter, he was assassinated. So we didn't know what would happen. But ever since, presidents annually would declare a Thanksgiving Day. Eventually under FDR, it was legally through Congress, it became a day. So we've had it ever since Abraham Lincoln as an official day. The interesting part about this is that it's only later that this Pilgrim and Indian story that we have about the Pilgrims came over and they had a hard time surviving the winter, and then the next year it was good and Indians helped them farm, and then they had this Thanksgiving, this story. That whole story is based only on one letter that was kind of lost and not discovered until the late 1800s. And then when people discovered it, they said, oh, this is the first Thanksgiving. And then they built a lot of mythology around it because there's not much detail in the one letter. And then that became our central Thanksgiving story. But it wasn't always. It was just, we should have a good time of Thanksgiving in the fall.
You know, Christmas always seems to be sort of the biggest thing of the year for a lot of us. But I mean, what about people that aren't Christian? Have people who are not necessarily Christian sort of taken this up as well, but in a different way?
Yeah, I think I've tried to analyze all these arguments we have about Christmas and the war on Christmas and the rest. I think we have to step back and realize, the way I put it is that what's developed now is we have a cultural Christmas and a Christian Christmas. And some people celebrate one or the other or both. Because there are a lot of people who celebrate what I would call a cultural Christmas, and they like it. I mean, I know a number of people who say Christmas is my favorite holiday of the year, but they don't ever go to church. Maybe they're Christian, maybe they're not. You know, one of the most interesting examples is Japan. I have, you know, some faculty and students I know from Japan. They say in there at Christmas time, about half the homes have Christmas trees. And there's special Christmas shopping, although not as much as ours, and lights in the malls and all of that. 2% of Japan is Christian. So what's happening there? And I think you'd have to say it's a cultural Christmas, just as people in the United States, all kinds of people celebrate it for various reasons. And for Christians, that the birth of Christ is one of the reasons. I think one reason it's so popular is that it's a midwinter party. And the more I think about that, we need a midwinter party. I mean, it gets not just cold, but dark. It's kind of like walking into death. You hope you're going to come out on the other side.
Yes.
So even if you didn't talk about Christianity or anything else, just imagine, what would you do to try to cope with winter? I've got an idea. Let's have a great big blowout midwinter party. And when would we have it? About when the days stop getting shorter and start getting longer again, which would be in the middle of December. And what would we have? We'd have a festival of lights to push back the darkness, like candles and logs and so on. And we'd have evergreens that stay green in the middle of winter. And we'd feast and get together with other people and maybe have presents and songs. Think of all that. That's a logical thing for people to do in the middle of winter. Cultures were doing that before Jesus even came. And heck, I live in an area of the United States where we have winter, right? I've sometimes said if I didn't live in a culture that already had a winter party, I'd make one up.
Yeah, you know, the next holiday, Valentine's Day, has also become a huge holiday from little kids on.
It kind of emerges out of courtly love traditions. If you've heard about the Middle Ages and the knights and they devote themselves. I mean, some of the earliest letters in that come from that. And the whiff of religion here is that it's named for Saint Valentine, so supposedly his saint's day, which is his death day. But really, it has nothing to do with Saint Valentine. It's just a day to recommit ourselves to relationships. It started out as letters and poems.
And then Easter, which to me always feels like, it just seems like there's really nothing in Easter that is bad to me, unless eating too much candy is bad.
Yes.
or getting too much candy from, you know, quote unquote, the Easter Bunny. But it is just it's such a great day. Even if it's cold and icky, you feel like, well, mm-hmm. it's spring. Spring mm-hmm. is coming. Mm-hmm. It's wonderful.
And I think Christian ministers would often say, even though with Christmas and Easter, a lot of people, Christmas is their favorite, in terms of Christian theology and so on, it's Easter that's most important.
It is.
And the big surprise for a lot of people is that, well, we talk about Christmas and Easter as the two big Christian holidays. The earliest Christians for the first 300 years did not celebrate Christmas, did not celebrate the birth of Jesus. It was all about the death and resurrection of Jesus. So it was like Easter, Easter, Easter. So it was, yeah, a primary celebration, and there's a lot of Christian meaning there. However, we do have some of that seasonal celebration. I mean, why do we have eggs? Why do we have Easter bunnies?
Right.
Those all have to do with spring fertility. But it's something that Christians could use for their own symbolism. I mean, like the egg and it hatches and the life coming out of the egg. See, I mean, that will work for...
Works for everybody.
Yeah, you can just use it. But a lot of candy. There is one person, I've talked to someone who owns a candy company, you know, and I said, you know, I'm working on these five holidays. Every single one is associated with candy. And he said, yeah, and that's not by accident.
Probably
it is
not.
Interesting. There's candy with every one of them.
Or and cards.
Yeah, that's right.
That was Morningside professor and chair of religious studies Bruce Forbes talking about his book, America's Favorite Holidays. Forbes recently updated the book for a new edition. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media.